Tribute.
I'm Brenda Dennehy.
I'm Julie Haynes.
And this is Left on Red.
Tony O'Reilly is an addiction counsellor who specialises in gambling addiction, an addiction he has lived through himself.
In 2011, Tony's life was splashed across the front pages after he stole 1.7 million euros from OnPos to fund that addiction. But since then, Tony has changed his life completely.
He went on to get his degree in counselling and psychotherapy and now delivers gambling addiction workshops to schools and organisations all over Ireland.
Tony also co-authored Tony 10, his best-selling book that tells the story of his gaming addiction and subsequent recovery.
And today he's sitting down with us to take us through his incredible journey.
Delighted to welcome Tony O'Reilly. Tony, I met you a couple of weeks ago and I could not wait to get you on our podcast thanks to the gripping story that you have. It's obviously a very emotional one, but I was at a... It was a kind of an addiction mental health talk there with you a couple of weeks ago and you were the first speaker and I kind of knew somewhat of your story, but you telling it, I mean, the whole room was just infatuated and gripped. You couldn't hear a penny drop. I suppose the backstory to it is about a gambling addiction and you're the best man to kind of fill us in on that addiction. But I suppose before we kind of get into it, can you tell us a bit like where you grew up and your background and all that?
So thanks a million for having me on.
Yeah,
I'm originally from Carlow Town, but living in Waterford at the moment. Grew up in the 70s and 80s, so I'm 50 last week. So yeah,
happy
so
it's, birthday.
Yeah, thank you very much. Not a great, bit depressing, but it's all good. Yeah, I had a very normal upbringing. Loved football, loved playing sports. And yeah, I suppose now I'm living down in Waterford the last 8 years with my partner at the moment. So it's all good.
And I suppose when I mentioned there at the top of the hour, I was saying just about the gambling addiction. Your story, when you're looking back, can you remember when the kind of first sign of any kind of an addiction you had, or your first bet, or anything like that?
The first bet, was written about a lot. It was the quarter final of the World Cup between Holland and Argentina and France '98, and I was 24 and I placed my first bet, which is ancient in comparison to what we're seeing nowadays. And I was working at a bar called Scrag's Alley in my hometown of Carlow, and there was a bookies right beside it, and I went in out of interest with my friend. And he was placing a few bets on different events, but I just decided to put a £1 bet on Patrick Kluivert to score first for Holland and Holland to win 2-1. And we went up to watch the match afterwards. The two of us put a pound on. He said I was mad to do it because the chances of it happening were so slim. And my exact words were, it's only a pound, it's only a bit of crack for the match. So we put the pound each onto it, went up, and Kluivert did score first after 12 minutes. And the buzz and excitement I got when that goal went in was something I'd never felt before. Huge sports fan, big Liverpool fan, watched them over the years, ups and downs. But this was something different. And then that was even heightened when Argentina equalised after about 17 or 18 minutes. And for the next 70 odd minutes, we kicked every ball, metaphorically headed every ball, telling everyone about the bet. Everyone was hoping Holland will win. And the game had sending offs and ups and downs. But I suppose Burkham scored one of the famous World Cup goals in the last minute and we won the bet. And that was the first time I placed a bet, but it was also a winning bet. And probably in today's terms, probably the equivalent of winning €200. So we went out for a free night out. We got drunk. We stole lemons from behind the bar and started reenacting the goal using the lemons on the bar floor. And I remember going to bed that night thinking, this is easy. This is an easy way to make money. So that was my first ever experience of placing a bet. And generally, when people develop a problem, it's usually a positive first experience. And that was very much the start of my gambling journey. But it didn't get bad for about 4 or 5 years until I opened up an online account. And it just took off in a different direction altogether.
And watching the match, I suppose it was a bit more exciting as well because you had a bet on. So did that change for you then as you're like, anytime there's a match on or a big soccer match, I'm going to put a couple of euro or a couple of pounds down?
Yeah. I suppose for the first couple of years, it would have been when I was working on Saturdays in the pub. I would have done a couple of bets on the accumulator for a Saturday afternoon. You'd be watching soccer Saturday while you're working. And, you know, you might win some weeks, you might lose. But I remember we did win €130 another week. And we had a free night out. So it was like, you know, like we win, we get a free night out. But it wasn't anything major. I would have just done it at the weekends. But then when I got the online account, very much what you said there, I was kind of betting on every single game.
Yeah.
I was gambling on matches all over the world. It wasn't just English Premier League matches or Irish matches.
So for the first 4 years, you were just going in, putting a couple, like, innocently putting a couple of pounds yep. down and then enjoying the match and whatever. So then when you joined the online world of betting, mm-hmm. that's then when things really kicked off.
Yeah, because I got a €50 voucher for Paddy Power for a present, which is an unusual present to yeah. get. But to use the voucher, you had to open up an online account. So I was doing bets like £5 and Roy Keane to get sent off, £5 and Michael Owen to score the first goal, bets like that. But then to lodge more money onto your online account, back then you had to do it by electronic means. Mm-hmm. So I had a credit card. So that was my lodgement method. I'm sure if you buy anything on credit, I'm sure
dangerous,
if anyone
yeah.
listening,
yeah.
it doesn't feel like real money.
yeah. Mm.
But if you're gambling on credit, it definitely doesn't feel like real money. So the amounts of bets started to go up and the amounts of time I spent gambling started to rise as well. And
just to go back
there.
As well, do you know when you're saying your first bet was 24, I suppose going back as a child, can you remember anything, any addictive patterns?
I can actually. It's when I was 10, my dad brought home an Amstrad CPC 464, one of the first home computers. That's definitely showing my age now. And a game called Fruit Machine came free with the computer. So you had to load it by cassette tape. That's how old it was. Yeah. And I'd spend hours on end pressing the space bar trying to get 3 sevens on this game and trying to get up the leaderboard. So that was very much my first kind of experience with kind of, I suppose, gaming and kind of gambling within gaming. But when I was younger, shopping was definitely something that was very prevalent. I would have bought things to make myself feel better, to feel secure in myself. I would have always felt a bit insecure in myself when I was younger. And shopping became, for me, I used to have the best of everything, like the best of stereos. I was one of the electronic, there was an electronic kind of store beside us. And I was one of the best customers. I used to get stuff on higher purchase. As soon as I'd one thing paid off, I'd buy another big telly or buy a stereo system. And when I was in my room surrounded by all the stuff, I felt secure in myself. So it was a false way of having that security. And I suppose when the gambling kicked in then, it was like, well, geez, I can win more money. I can buy more stuff. So it was kind of, two of them went kind of hand in hand.
So you went online, and what was your first big bet then online?
The one I always say changed everything was it was the final of the UEFA Cup in 2005. CSK Moscow were playing Sport in Lisbon. And I arrived home from work. CSK Moscow were 1-0 down at half time and were 10-1 to win the game. So I decided I was going to put €50 on it. Now, that would have been an average bet there. Yeah. You know, after about a year of having an online account, I was probably about €1,000 on debt on my credit card at the same time as well. So I was just about to hit bet now. And that's the first time I hit my gambling because my partner was sitting beside me on the couch and I moved the laptop to the left so she couldn't see what I was doing. And I was just about to hit bet now when I saw that West Ham were playing Ipswich in the playoff semi-final. So I put a player called Bobby Zamora in as a first goal scorer. So I'd done a €50 double. Mm. Went up to have a shower, come down to watch the second half. Within 11 or 12 second half minutes, CSK Moscow equalised them 2-1 up. Then Bobby Zamora scored the first goal and I let a huge shout out in the sitting room celebrating. And I generally don't want to shout to tell you unless Liverpool are playing. So my partner stuck her head in the kitchen and said, what's the story? Liverpool playing? And I said, no, that's next week. It was the Champions League final 2005. I was definitely screaming that night. But the that's the first time I lied about my gambling because I told her I had a €10 bet on and I had 6 or 7 football teams in the accumulator. And I told her I was due to win €700. And just to kind of keep everything sweet, I told her that if I did win, I'd give her €500 towards getting stuff for the wedding that was coming a few years later. So
how much did you win?
€4,950.
And you told her you won how much?
700. So what happened then was I paid off the 1,000 off the credit card, put the money into her account, put money into my own account to buy some vinyl, the huge record collection back then. But I left just over €3,000 on my Paddy Power account and I saw it as free money. Yeah. So I started chasing that winning feeling and then I lost that within the space of a week. And then I started chasing a loss and I lost, I think I maxed out my credit card within the space of 4 or 5 weeks after that. So my gambling addiction really started with a €5,000 win.
And you lost €3,000
in space of a week.
1 week.
Yeah. And Tony, how were things then? She was your fiancée at the time and you were going on to get married. Had she any idea of the problem you had with
no,
gambling?
No, because I could get loans pretty easily back in the banks back then. So I was able to get loans very quickly and very easily. But also because I worked in the post office, I could intercept the mail. So no one saw the bank statements coming in with all the loan transactions. No one saw the credit card statements coming in with 7 or 8 pages of Paddy Power transactions. And you didn't know much money I was even earning because I used to hide that as well. So your whole life becomes about hiding everything from everyone. So no one had a clue right up until the very end.
And it's an easy addiction to hide as well because I think with drink, you could kind of smell the drink or, you know, they might be slurring their words or whatever. But with you, you just turn the laptop around and you're betting away, do you know?
Yeah, and then when the phones come in, it's like we're all spend a lot of times on our phones, so like you could be gambling away, chatting to anyone. Gambling
exactly, yeah. And you were working then as well?
Yeah.
So you were working in a post office?
Yeah.
So was most of your wages then going into Paddy Power, into Ladbrokes and all these?
So I was moving up through the organisation. Like I got, I started off as a postman, then I became a post office clerk, then I moved up to become one of the youngest branch managers in the country. So the wages were coming up, but I was lying about the wage increase. I kept saying, oh, sure, I'm not earning that much money, I'm on probation, I'm not going to, you know, you're just full of lies the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
So like career-wise and family-wise, everything alongside the gambling was perfect, like my life was good. But the gambling just kind of started to creep in and start tarnishing every single thing that was good in my life.
Were you just doing soccer? Or did you branch out then from soccer? Because you seem like you just started with soccer.
Yeah, started with soccer.
And you enjoyed it,
when I went online, you can gamble on the next available event. So I was gambling on Azerbaijan basketball, Peruvian netball, Russian under 13.
With no clue even of...
The next available event, I think I even shared in the school talks that I even won money on Rosanna Davis in the time she won Miss World for Ireland.
Oh my God.
So I'm gambling on every single thing that's available.
And how many bets would you do a day at your worst time?
I used to do a lot of accumulators, so it could be three or four events would be going on. You'd be gambling at the very end of it, you'd be gambling 17, 18 hours a day because you'd be checking results, trying to hide it, looking at events and stuff like
that's
that.
That's a full-time job, like. That's incredible. Wow, like. If somebody brought me to Paddy Power, I don't think I'd know how to put on a bet, would you? I don't know how to write
I probably
stuff.
Wouldn't, to be honest. I have to be careful about myself. I don't know, but I joke about it. Actually, I think I said this to you. I kind of joked about it to my mother because obviously I have the all alcohol addiction, the all prescription drugs, but I never forget they in Cunvera, they had the family days.
Yeah.
They have a family day every weekend. She came over one day, she goes, no, the gambling, no, you just have to. And I was kind of laughing. She goes, no, I'm serious. And you know what? When she said it, I was like, I am very careful about it. I probably wouldn't go into Paddy Power or anything because the odd time I've done a bet and I get that big high, that big high and the win. And the worst thing they can say, the worst thing for a gambler is to win because they keep on going, And looking back then, Tony, I know there was a big instance towards your wedding when you were getting ready. How much debt were you in before you got married?
About 45,000 in debt. Because and as soon as I maxed out the credit card start, I got a loan, paid it off, and I was always trying to win that money back. So about 45,000 euro,
So you might pay back the loan, but then you're chasing, you're like, I'll keep going here now again. And it's a vicious circle, like, isn't it?
It is, because with alcohol, as you were saying, I think we can all agree you can't drink yourself sober, but you know, you feel you can gamble your way out of it. And you know, pride, ego, fear was stopping me looking for help or support. So I just kept on trying to gamble my way over.
And were you still going into the premises or was it mostly online?
Mostly online, because I didn't want anyone questioning if you're putting 400 euro in a basketball match halfway across the world.
Yeah, especially that you live in a small town as well, and I suppose people talk as well.
Of course.
And then there was I'm just I know when you were getting married in Cyprus, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a certain incident where you were getting married, you needed the fee for the reception.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that story? What happened then?
So I suppose I gambled all the money twice over for the balance of the wedding. So when the day I got married, I didn't wake up thinking how beautiful a wife's going to look or how the day was going to go, whether the best man was going to make an ass of me during the best man speech, which he did. Mm. All I was thinking about was, will this horse win in 2 days' time? Because I was waiting on a horse called Arthurize to win the Derby, ridden by Frankie Dettori. And I needed that to win to be able to pay the balance of the wedding of just over 6,000 euro. So like 2 days after the wedding, no one has a clue. Everyone's oblivious to it. I'm trying to keep up this front of everything's okay, even the day of the wedding. But the day of the wedding, I was stressed. I wasn't myself. Again, it was one of many things gambling tarnished. But I remember sitting on the bed 2 days after the wedding, and the race was on the telly because one of the big races in England. And sitting there thinking, if this horse doesn't win, I'm not going to be able to pay the balance of the wedding. But luckily, the horse won, or unluckily, I don't know what way to look at it, because it gave me that belief that I can always gamble my way out of every situation.
What do you think you would have done if the horse didn't win? And you're with that fee, probably beg, borrow, steal for paying?
Because I was out in Cyprus, I wouldn't have had any option other than come clean about it.
And do you ever look back on that and kind of go, I wish that horse... Is there many instances where you go, I wish that horse didn't win?
Yeah, I think that's probably one, because maybe I probably would have had to face up to the problem earlier. But then again, would I have faced up to it and dealt with it? Would I have sorted and maybe said, maybe I'll go back in again? You know, similar to what you were sharing about the alcohol, you think I'm okay, maybe I can go back and do it a different way. I think it probably needed to go to where it went in my story for me to really get that low point or that
the big rock
bottom. And then you went home after mm-hmm. getting married and you were able to pay the balance because the horse won. What happened then once you came back to Ireland?
I couldn't get any more loans at the time because the banks had told me not to come back to them for 2 years at least because I was maxed out with loans. So I decided I was going to devise a system to beat the bookies.
Okay.
So I started researching horse racing, researching soccer matches, everything. Now my gambling changed. I couldn't get any bets online, so I reverted back to going into the bookies. So I was doing a lot more lottery gambling, trying to win big amounts. I was doing 10 euro bets on 15 team accumulators, trying to win tens of thousands in one go, like doing these mad bets. So I was waiting to get that loan off the bank, and my plan was to beat the bookies. So I got a loan a couple of months later off the bank again, when I cleared off a bit of loan, and started gambling again. But if you have a gambling addiction, you don't wait till the weekend, till the good soccer's on, the good race's on. You start gambling on the next available event and stuff like the Azerbaijan basketball and stuff like that. I lost that money in the space of a couple of weeks. Then I got another loan a couple of months later, and so on and so on.
And we're at this stage, you were going into the premises?
No, still online. Oh, always still online. So I get the loan and I transfer electronically onto my Paddy Power account.
Yeah. And I wonder if you were going in like every day and making all these different bets, do you think the lady or the man behind the counter would be like, would red flags, like would they say, okay, I think you have enough? Is there any system there or...
There is, but probably not as much back then. Like, the safer gambling is a little bit better nowadays, but still far off from where it should be. Like, back then, there was no one saying stop to me. Like, you know, they were still taking the money. But I was bringing in, I suppose at the latter stage of the gambling, I was bringing in large amounts of money and they were just taking it over the counter and putting it onto my online account. I used to gamble mainly in Gorey and in Carlo Paddy Power, but sure, they used to buy me presents because I was a great tipper. So when I won money, because I didn't want them questioning it, I'd leave a bit of a tip.
A couple of bob there. Yeah, like,
and the woman in Gorey, she actually knitted a cardigan for my daughter for her christening. So like that's manipulative.
A relationship.
It's a manipulative relationship though, because you don't want them to question anything.
No, I get that. Oh my God.
And then Tony, I suppose you were gambling your own money for a certain amount of time and then things changed where you had to get the funds from somewhere else.
That's a nice way of putting it.
The kinder way of doing it.
So I suppose I had just exhausted all means to get money and I was still so desperate to try gambling my way out that I started stealing from my employer. And I justified or rationalised it, I just borrow it. Like to say, for fraud to happen, there has to be three elements, pressure, opportunity and rationalisation. The pressure I was under was immense. The opportunity was that I had access to the safes. And I rationalised, I just borrow some money and I'll pay it back. Sure, I'm going to win. Sure, like I'm after research and everything, I'm going to win. But I started stealing from my employer. Started off with a couple of coin here and there. I used to manipulate coin bags to make them look full.
Because you were working actually post office.
I was the manager as well, so I had access to the full safe. So I knew the systems. I was able to manipulate systems. So the coin bags for €2 would come, kind of a pink bag with €1,000 in it, 20 bags of 50s, as far as I remember. I used to take out 3 or 4 bags of €2 coins, so it'd be 150 or €200. And I put in a 10 cent bag instead because it's the same weight as 3 litre bags.
Yes.
So that I knew that the audit team come in, they'd weigh the bag and it'd be near enough the same.
Yes.
And you'd have it sealed so they wouldn't open it. And I knew that from kind of watching other audits. So when you have a gambling, you start becoming very resourceful. You start watching and it sows the seed in the back of your head of ways you may be able to get money.
Yeah.
And then I stole a couple of €100 and then it quickly escalated into thousands of euro. So I used to actually take it from bales of cash. So the money for the social welfare or the pensions will come in 10 bundles of 5,050s sealed in this kind of plastic wrap. And I get a blade and I'd slice down the corner of the bale of notes and get needle nose pliers, put out €2,000 or €3,000 from a bundle, seal it back up, put a little black mark so I knew which bundle was missing money and I put it in at the back of the safe. So to the naked eye, it looked like €50,000, when in fact it might be only 47 or 48,000. So by the time I got my first cash audit, I'd stolen €8,000. So 3 of these bundles were missing money. And I knew from my experience of seeing the audits in the past that generally if they look full, they just count them.
Yeah.
10 bundles. But so I got through my first cash audit.
How long was that going on? How long were you robbing now from this post office?
It was only a short period. Probably, I'd say I still haven't really put a finger on it. I'd say it was just over a year. It started off with that. And then I remember I had one of those rare moments of clarity when the audit team left. There was only a fella on his own doing a cash audit. When he left, I rang my mum and I asked for help. But I didn't ask for help in my gambling, and I asked for financial help. So I got a loan of €8,000
from your mum.
And I thought it was for mortgage payments or something. I made up something like, again, the blue eyed boy manipulating situations. Yeah. And then I got the check. I dragged her into the credit union in Carlow, got her to get this loan out, and I was to take on the repayments.
Yeah.
And so I had the check in my pocket one Thursday, and my plan was to put it into the safe. And before I got a chance to put the check back in the safe, the second audit arrived and they take over the office for the full day. Mm. So I'm sitting there with a check in my pocket, they're checking the safes. They took out 5 bundles out of that particular safe that day, and 3 of them bundles are missing cash, were 3 to 5 that were left in the back of the safe. So I got away with it.
Yeah.
And you can imagine, like, they're even saying, I will see you in a couple of months, Tony. Fair play, the office is running really well. And those words are ringing in my ears because I'm supposed to put this check back in. Yeah. But I go to the safe and kind of go, right, they're not coming back for another couple of months. I've already gotten away with this once.
Yeah.
I get away with it again. So instead of putting the 8,000 back in that I'd stolen, that was my plan, yeah, I took the money, put into my Paddy Power account and started gambling. And then I lost that within a few weeks as well.
Oh,
and then I started stealing more and more money.
Gosh.
Was there any time that you were hoping they caught you?
Probably near the end, I'd say, because I was so... It's kind of mad to describe. You just go into this gambling bubble or frenzy or fog or whatever you want to call it, and you're just desperately just trying to fix it. So it's at moments you come out and you kind of go, geez, what am I after doing? But I always was convinced I could gamble my way out of it, because that's the gambler's fallacy. You're convinced that a big win has come, and all you do is keep on doing the bet. You're bound to win. I suppose at the end, I was kind of, you know, I was just done with it at the end. Like, I won huge amounts at the end.
Was it like 9 or 10? How much did you win in full?
I think I won nearly half a million euro one weekend. Yeah. I'd done 146 bets and won 125 bets, won 46. But the problem is I'd stolen double that. So, like, it was just mental. It was.
Do you know how much roughly you stole from the post office?
1.75 million.
1.75 million you stole from the
even
post
office?
Even
when I say it nowadays, it's 13 years ago, and even when I say it now, it's mental.
I suppose going back to before, kind of like, I suppose, your big rock bottom, I suppose, your wife got pregnant. Mm-hmm. She got pregnant during kind of this period when you were kind of taking funds from the post office.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying that how you felt at the time should have been the happiest time in your life.
Yeah, it should have been, but it was tinged with sadness because I knew I was in a world of trouble. I think I'd stolen about €68,000 at that stage. And I knew I was in a world of trouble. You know, it was one of the best moments of my life when my daughter was born, but you're just kind of thinking, what kind of world am I after bringing her into? I'm a horrible person. I'm not, you know, you're that self-loathing that comes with being in addiction or being in that space. And I'm just thinking, like, how am I after getting here? But then you're always thinking of, I'll just place a bigger bet and I'll get over it. And I had moments where, you know, there was a moment where one team let me down for 14 team accumulator that would have got me back. But even if I had gotten back, I would have started again.
Was there ever a time where you're like, I will stop now? Mm. Like, I'd be like that before with the alcohol, but this is my last night now, this is my last can now. I'm trying to be at it again the next morning. Yeah. But was there ever a period where you did probably go a day or two and you thought, look, I'm going to recover at the early stage.
I think there's always, I can't remember which World Cup it was, probably 2006 World Cup. Or it could be 2010, I'm not sure. But I remember I won €10,000 on a bet, and I remember thinking to myself, like, this, it was the only time I would have been up, and I said, right, pay off your loans, you have €1,000 left, get a holiday and that's it. But the Galway race was on the following week, and I was, I sure don't need a holiday, I'll just spend €1,000. And I just ended up gambling it all, and I lost it all. And that was like that morning I woke up and said, right, I'm not going to do it, this is it, I'm done with it now, I'm after getting back. But that was probably one of the only times. I remember I was talking to my friend Niall at the counter in Scrags. I was out that night. I was telling him, geez, I have to win a lot of money. No, I didn't tell him how much I won.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, just mind yourself with that, Tony. You're talking about it a little bit more than you usually would. Just mind yourself with that. But I lost that €10,000 in the space of 3 or 4 days in the Galway races.
And you know the feeling of losing the money then, Tony. Can you describe that to people, you know, who don't have a gambling addiction or people who don't gamble?
It's hard to describe it because it's extreme ups and downs. Like you could be dancing around winning loads of money 1 minute, and after, you know, you gamble nearly all of it the following minute. It's that the lowest point. I remember, like, you know, when my wife was having morning sickness at that stage of pregnancy, I was waking up each morning and dry retching and getting sick with stress in the other bathroom. Like that, it's like when you feel real stress and it feels like your stomach's just going to fall out. You know, that feeling you get when you get a bad news about something. It's nearly that the whole time. And it was nearly like there was someone constantly, the only way I used to describe it was someone was constantly there with the pressure on my head, like holding my head for the all time, always putting pressure on it. So it was always that sense of, a sense of being lost, I suppose, in yourself. Like it just, it was like I was a different person. It's very hard to describe.
It's an out of body experience, yeah. I would say.
And the lowest of the low you could ever feel, probably feeling that probably most of the day. And you wake up in the morning, you kind of go, do you know that you wake up in the morning and kind of go, yeah, everything's okay, and then you remember.
Oh, yeah.
You know yourself from your own experience. You kind of go, oh God, here we go again.
And how long was this going on?
I suppose the addiction part of it probably 6 or 7 years. The real stress part of it probably about 14 or 15 months.
So in those 6 or 7 years, you stole 1.75 million.
No, I would have started stealing money. Probably it would have been only a short period of time. I would have started stealing money probably in May or June, April or May, and I would have been scored probably over about 14 months was all the money was stolen. And in the latter stages, I was stealing €75,000 a week. So just grabbing 3 bundles of 50s every day, €15,000, putting into my backpack and going into Paddy Power and gambling.
And at that stage, were you even trading? Like at the start, you were saying you were changing the €2 to the 10 cents. Were you even trying to cover it off at that stage?
Just changing figures in the balance sheet. You were so desperate to get it back in before the audit came in. You were just doing stupid bets, like €40,000 in the Norwegian women's football team.
Oh my God.
€30,000 on football bets. Stuff like anything just to get it back all in once.
Because it started off with like €1 on whatever team.
Yeah.
Your first bet up to, what was your highest bet?
€40,000.
On a women's team?
The Norwegian women's football team.
Did they win?
No.
It's a lot.
6-4 bet, so I would have won 100,000. But I won huge amounts. But you don't enjoy it at any stage. Like, you know, same with the alcohol. The enjoyment goes out of it at the very early stages when you're addicted to it. It's just, for me, it was always about trying to get money back. But it was always about trying to alleviate the stress that was, as you mentioned, it was a vicious cycle. It was just trying to alleviate the stress I was under.
And then, I suppose, we lead up to the rock bottom. You were taking more and more from the post office. Can you lead up to, I know that you had gone up north and can you tell us about...
Yeah, so I'd gone through 3 audits. The third audit, I'd stolen €293,000. So I remember, the walls were starting to come in around me. Like it was probably May, June, and we got a surprise audit, and I arrived into work on the Wednesday. And I remember I was at the Budweiser Irish Derby as a VIP the week before. Like as a VIP, you get brought to all these events. And my friends were saying, "How'd you get tickets for this thing?" I won them. You know, I'd be telling lies. But that Wednesday, I arrived into work and there was a surprise audit. I saw the cars outside because I knew the Port Leash Reg car. So I just spun my own car around and I sped out of Gorey. I nearly crashed the car driving out. I hit a humpback bridge in the car and nearly flipped over Low Line Bridge into the river. I got up to Belfast and the first place I went was to the bookies. And I suppose I was still gambling online trying to win the money back because I thought, right, you know, now I'm caught. If I get the money back, it's something, you know, like at least it won't be as bad. And I ended up... losing all my money online, but then winning money on a physical docket. I used to do a lot of bets in the bookies as well. And I was so desperate to get that fix of gambling, I actually went into a bookie office on a Friday night trying to cash in this docket, knowing full well that they would have to ring Gorey to validate the docket, who in turn would ring the Gardaí and let them know where I was. So what happened when I left that bookie office that night, I was caught on CCTV cameras. The pictures were circulated. My dad got a look at this picture when he was in the Garda station looking for me. My best friend and I, like, gone around all the beaches in Wexford and Waterford looking for me, thinking they were going to find me dead because the news of the theft and the amounts of money started to filter through. And I remember the morning I placed my last ever bet, or the afternoon, because I was drinking heavily the night before. It was a horse called Badea, the 150 in Newbury, or Beverly, sorry, beg your pardon. And I remember when I was looking at that horse race, I opened the newspaper and I saw some of the headlines. You know, the news had broken overnight. And I'll never forget, all I remember in the article was family and friends are looking for him in the Wicklow Mountains. I said, I may make contact with my family. So I went home, I'd thrown away my mobile phone, SIM card and everything. So I started emailing everyone and they were texting back saying or writing back in emails, where are you? We're worried about you. And then I heard that they were in Belfast looking for me and something clicked in my head. And I Googled how to take my own life a couple of weeks before that. And I decided I can't do this anymore. So I decided I was going to take my own life. I had the means to carry out my plan with me. And I sent one final email. I said, tell my daughter I'll always love her. And I sent that email. I nearly go every time I say that. And I sent that. I didn't actually say that. I said something else. But if I said what I said, I'd break down crying.
Yeah.
But I remember when I sent it, I threw the laptop into the corner and I thought, this is it. This is the end of my life. This, I'm going to die alone in room number 6 in a hotel in Carrickfergus. But my family, the night before, my dad had seen me on the CCTV still leaving the Paddy Power. He made out cobblestones outside. So when I went back to the family meeting that was going on in my house at the time, they noticed that, he got my sister to Google map all the Paddy Powers in Belfast. There was 13 at the time. One of them had cobblestones outside. So they got the address of the Paddy Power, the cobblestones, and went up the following day to try find me. And I went into the Paddy Power, and luckily the fellow was on for who was on the night before, because I had told him when I was trying to cash in my docket, there was a problem cashing in the docket or something, because they wouldn't cash it in because of the theft. But I told him I was staying in Carrickfergus that I cashed in. So my family arrived into Belfast, and then when they got that email saying I was going to take my, or sent to my daughter-in-law, his lover, they kind of put two and two together, said he's going to take his own life. So when they arrived in and the emails were going back and forth, and when I said, tell my daughter I love his lover, my wife broke down in the Paddy Power office, and it was only then that he gave the information that I said I was staying in Carrickfergus. So they flew into Carrickfergus. They're going around hotel to hotel trying to find me. I was booked in under my friend's name. I remember Niall, I was booked in under his name. He went into Dobbins in hotel where I was staying. And he felt the woman was a bit off at him in behind reception. So when he came back out, he rang the PSNI, Police Force in Northern Ireland. And he said, I'm worried about my friend. We think he's in this hotel. Can you come down? Because the woman won't give us any information. And I'm up in room 6 in this hotel, oblivious to all that's going out in the street. Yeah. So I get a phone call about 5 o'clock that evening saying, hi, Mr. Byrne, do you want your room cleaned? And I said, they never ring at 5 o'clock in the evening. So I get up out of bed and I go to the window to look out. Paranoid as hell, and I got a knock on the door and I turned around and there's two PSNI officers with guns standing at the door. One of them stepped into the room, said, Tony, we're not here to arrest you, we're here because we're worried about your mental health and your state of mind. And that's my first ever experience to counseling psychotherapy, because I broke down and everything came flowing out. He stood there for an hour and listened to me. I just collapsed on the bed and everything came flying out, and he left and my family members came in out of the room, and the relief was absolutely huge, but I suppose it was short-lived, I suppose, because it started to hitch it into the enormity of it all. So it eventually got me into the back of my sister's car. Herself and her husband drove me back down to Carlo, stopping in to get a bottle of water. My pictures in front of all the national newspapers. The news had broken publicly overnight because the amounts of money involved and because of the two organisations involved on Post and Paddy Power. And but it wasn't until I got home and saw my mum for the first time that it really hit me. Like, the look of disgust and disappointment she gave me, I'll never forget for as long as I live. And that's when I knew I really had to,
change things.
And look at this, yeah.
There was an ironic moment as well, Tony. I think, was it when you were pulling up to the audit, whatever, that actually Paddy Power himself rang you?
Yeah, that would have been a previous audit. So the weekend I'd won €462,000. Like, I woke up on a Tuesday morning thinking, this is it, just double the money up and you'll win it all back. And so I used to gamble while I was driving. The only way I can describe it is that, like, you know, I needed to have a bet first thing in the morning to stop me feeling like my head was going to explode. So I was trying to place bets this morning, and I used to gamble while I was driving. The mornings that I wasn't gambling when I was driving, I had an old portable DVD player. I used to jam it into the dashboard of the car and watch episodes of Prison Break while I was driving, just to keep my head from feeling like it was going to go
thinking.
Mad. Just to try.
It's like a switch off.
Yeah, it was mad. Because you think driving would do that enough on its own. But so I remember that morning I got into work and I set up the laptop, and I opened up my Paddy Power account. There's €462,000. The online systems were down that morning. I couldn't place a bet while I was driving. And I looked over the safe and I went, I just double up the money, because I'd stolen €900,000 at this stage. And that moment I looked up to the cameras, I saw the audit team walking in. But it was three different lads from Dublin. Mm. And they came in and said, Tony, we're here to check security. And I'm shaking, handing the keys to the safe, because I think they're going to open the safe. There's nearly €1 million missing. And they said, no, we don't need that. We're here to check the viability, putting in a Dropbox safe. And I said, what's a Dropbox safe? And they said, oh, it's, you know, where the secure core fellas have put the money in through
the hatch,
through the wall. And this will heighten security no end. And I was just thinking, if only they knew, like, the person stealing money from this one stand in front of them, they don't have to worry about anyone else. So they measured up, and probably, you know, myself to yourself aware, Brenda, they were measuring up. And I got a phone call in that moment. I'll never forget the kind of answer. It was an 087 number, I think. And I remember I answered the phone and the person at the end of the line said, "Hi, is this Tony?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Who's this?" And he said, "Hi, this is Paddy Power." And I went, "Paddy Power?" And he said, "Yeah, from the organisation." So the head man rang me that morning and he said to me, "Tony, this is my private number. If you need to ring me to place a bet," because the systems were down. And I was kind of thinking, no, you're okay. So I just ushered him off the phone. Now, I've heard since it wouldn't be unusual for that to happen because I was one of their biggest customers at the time. But I was imagine like being on the, him on the phone, a million nearly missing out of the safe, half a million on your online account. It didn't matter because I started gambling a few minutes later when the audit team left, the online systems came back online. And 31 bets later, 30 losing bets later, and 12 hours later, I'd lost nearly half a million euro online.
Oh my God.
Just a series of 20,000 euro bets and just lost it all. And then the following day, I started the whole process again.
And to fast forward again, to your rock bottom, your disappointment with your mother, obviously there was consequences to face. Mm-hmm. I suppose, did you realise then I have a problem that you had a gambling addiction? I mean,
Probably not.
I hadn't realised it then.
I tried to get into all the different private clinics. I had health insurance, but gambling wasn't covered on any health insurance back then. So I went into Cung Vera in a tie, and I still went in thinking, sure, so I was only, you know, I don't have a problem. Like, I'm not, look at all them people.
Yeah, bad luck. You were thinking they'll teach
me how to do properly.
I remember I was flying around looking for Oisín McConville's book called The Gambler, trying, because I thought that'll have all the answers. Sure, let's read that and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
How naive. And I remember going into the door and seeing like Cung Vera, a place where I changed myself, not anyone else.
Yes, I know.
This trauma going in. Like, and when I was walking into Cung Vera, like, you know, the drug unit was there as well, and there were six lads in pajamas downstairs the door, and I said, what kind of place? In the Paisley pajamas. I said, what kind of place is this?
I'm laughing because I was the exact same when I went in.
Yeah. And I went in, I remember I was rattling going in, and I just thought, God, this is... But then I remember when I was doing the assessment with the nurse, I felt the non-judgmental and I felt the empathy, and
absolutely,
that really helped me settle in. Yeah, I done the 3 month program. Like, I celebrate my daughter's first birthday in there. Like, I always share, I don't know whether I shared it the other night, but I always share the story. It just shows you how gambling wasn't looked at back then as a real issue. It was my daughter's first birthday, and the family brought in a cake. And there's a picture, of me and my daughter and the birthday cake. And minutes after that photograph was taken, one of the nuns came over and said, "Hi, folks, do you want to buy a ticket for a raffle for a fundraiser?"
Oh.
I kind of got aiming for gambling. And of course, my wife says, "Yeah, sure, she bought tickets, so it's only," and I said, "Why are you doing buying a ticket? They think I'm gambling, I get kicked out," because I knew I had to be there for court case reasons and for obviously trying to get, like, that was my main thing, first of all, going in for court case.
Of course.
Yeah. That's what you used to hear in Cumbria. You hear for yourself or for courts or for family.
Kids, yeah.
And I remember, like, she bought a ticket and I got called out to the nurse's station about a week later, and you know yourself, you're only called down if you're on Librium or if you're in trouble. And she called me into the back and she said, "Can you give that to your wife?" And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Oh, your wife won first prize in a raffle. She won 500 euro. So I'm in for a gambling. So my wife wins first prize in a raffle. But then she gets me the check." It'd be like someone saying, "Oh, your partner won a bottle of whiskey in a draw. Here you go. You bring it home to her." So,
Was there money in there at your time for gambling?
It was only three or four. I think it was 120 in Cumbria at the time. It was only three or four in for gambling
for
at the time.
And you were one of them?
I was one. But the other lads were in for alcohol as well.
Okay.
So you never really had developed any issues with alcohol, did you?
No. I would have abused it every so often. Mine was mainly process addictions. Like, it was kind of shopping, gambling, and probably eating as well. Probably comfort eating would be a big thing I would have done over the years, but not so much alcohol. I would have abused it every so often, but not, like, I still have the odd drink. Yeah.
And you mentioned there, obviously, you went in, obviously, you know, for court reasons and all that. You obviously had to face the consequences. Yeah. Can you fill us in a bit about that?
So I left Cung Vera in October of that year, and then I was arrested 3 months later in December. I was processed and charged and told it would take about a year or so to go to prison. So I suppose, you know, you're waiting for that to come up. I'm back doing voluntary work in Cung Vera because I got so much from it. I wanted to give back and try help other people coming through with gambling, because gambling wasn't really done, I suppose, as much as it is now in the Cung Veras. And, but you got arrested, handcuffed, charged, released on bail. I was told to take a year to go to court. Started working back in the pub. That was tough as well because, you know, people knew the story.
Yeah.
And then you'd be always mindful of people think I'm stealing from the tills. Or,
yeah, I know.
So I'll never forget, like, a year later on, I think it was December the 18th, I was brought down to Circuit Court in Wexford, and I was told to expect between 5 and 7 years in prison for what I'd done. But there was a lot of mitigating circumstances that would chip away at the standards. Like, I hadn't benefited financially from the money. I wasn't driving around a big car.
Yeah.
I wasn't going on holidays. I wasn't leading a flash lifestyle or anything. Like, yeah. All the money I'd taken went directly into the Paddy Power or into gambling. Every single penny. And I was able to kind of prove that, and that kind of mitigated the circumstances. And like, I'm still paying back gambling related loans as we speak to them, still driving a piece of crap of a car that barely gets me around to schools. So the judge then decided, I'll never forget, I was standing in the dock, I suppose, one you might call it. And I talked to someone in Coomber before and said, if the judge starts talking about the negative things first, you're okay. If he starts talking about the positive things first, you're in a bad space. So I remember she started talking about the negative. I said, right, I'm okay. It's just negative. You're on your own. I'm playing the memorari in my head. You know the one?
Yeah. Oh gracious. Yeah.
So yeah. I'm, that's going on in my head. And it did help. And I got loads of holy medals from all the I never, they were brilliant throughout, I must say. Like,
same as,
you could hear them jangling in your pocket with the shaking. Yeah, and I remember I heard the word six and I just looked on my friend who just shook her head. And then she walked it back. So I ended up with, getting a 4-year prison sentence, one suspended for theft and falsifying accounts.
And where did you serve that then?
I ended up, the night before that I was remanded in Clover Hill. Then I was brought to Wheatfield, and then I was moved down to Midlands and Portlaoise.
How did you find prison life then?
Tough, but I suppose going through treatment that prepared me mentally for it. I was fairly mentally tough at this stage, totally different than the introvert Tony from my younger days. But I was mentally prepared for, but nothing can prepare you for going in there. Like, you know, even the intake, the sitting on the x-ray machine with a small towel around you, handed a carbolic soap and a pack with, I journaled a lot when I was there as well. So I would have navigated the early bit of the sentence. But it's when I got up to the Midlands, it's mad. Like, you think you know people, because there was a person that would have been seen as the local troublemaker in the town. He was actually in the Midlands. He was like the Don of the landing. And he came off self-imposed 23-hour lockdown to make sure I was okay on the landing. Like, you know, he used to walk up and down the landing with me, and he'd be asking me about the post office and about the systems. He was trying to get information himself. But he really helped me. Like, I worked in the kitchens, I came back, and he'd always invite you in for in the evenings and into his cell, like in for a coffee. It's like a real social thing. But it was like, he made sure I navigated the early parts of it. And, you know, I've not good things to say, but I'm like, you know, it's gas that you would have a judgment about someone until you actually meet them in a different environment. And I remember he really helped me. I got moved to the open prison fairly early in the sentence as well.
Is that because you were on good behaviour, or was it because...
Yeah, I was working in the kitchens. Right. You're on an enhanced landing, you're in the kitchens. The more you do, like, stay off the landings, work in the kitchens, engage at the school and stuff, like, the more chance you have of getting into an open prison quicker. And I think there's probably a few strings pulled behind the scenes as well, I think.
And did you serve the 3 years then?
Served 18 months. So I was released on something called a community return scheme, which is after half the sentence, you're eligible to go out... you're released back into care or probation, signing on once a day in the Garda station, once a week in the prison, picking up papers around the local community, stuff like that. But you do get a chance to get your life kind of back on track. So,
and how did you get your life back on track then?
I studied to become a counsellor, I suppose, while I was in... before I was sentenced, I'd done a foundation course in counselling psychotherapy. When I was in Shelton Abbey, one of the most important people in my recovery journey to date, one of the school teachers, asked me what I wanted to do when I left prison. And I actually done my first year of my degree from Shelton Abbey, from a prison cell. And when I got out, that kind of helped navigate it, because you had a bit of a purpose and a drive. And also, I wanted to be able to tell my daughter when she was of age that, yeah, I messed up. These are all mistakes, mate, but this is what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
So I tried to dedicate my life to
helping others.
And I kind of promised my mum that before she passed away as well. I was going to try. Let me go, and here we go again. Every time, like, I was going to try to have some good come out of it. And, like, that was a mantra that I kind of try to live by. There was a great book called Zen and the Art of Happiness by Chris Prentice, and there was one line, what good thing will come of this, and I try to live my life to that, like, what good could come out of any bad situation. So I kind of I suppose since then I've been kind of trying to help and support others in their journey of recovery, trying to help create awareness around this problem, often at personal cost as well, and obviously it brings it up for a lot of other people as well and hurts a lot of people, but trying to create awareness around this hidden addiction so that someone might have the courage that I didn't have to come out and ask for that help. I do a lot of school talks.
I was just about to ask that about the school talk. Like, how do you tell a group of lads, like young lads that are into soccer, that are into sport, that are into horses, whatever, to mind yourselves? Like, do you know what?
It's how you, I suppose, how you kind of portray the message. I'm not anti-gambling in any shape or form, but I am anti-gambling harm. I'm sure you're not anti-alcohol, but I just can't do it.
Yeah.
So I don't go in and preach at them and say, this is what you shouldn't do or should do. I say, this is what can happen and this is what happened to me. And again, I suppose I speak very authentically about it and they can probably pick up on that. So I do this story through PowerPoint.
Okay.
And the sports element, and I've a couple of funny videos in there as well, like that kind of engages. But then you will do a little bit more about psychoeducation around probability and chance and game design and a little bit of gaming and gambling in the second part of the presentation. So you do 2 hours with the students. Generally hold their attention for the 2 hours, which is good.
Well, it's a very interesting story, to be fair, Tony. My jaw is on the floor here. Like, and you have a book as well out, Tony 10, is it?
Yeah, it was written. It's out about 6 years now.
Yeah, Tony, the bestseller. Just looking at her,
It got shortlisted for some awards. It got shortlisted for the non-fiction book of the year. Sponsored by On Post.
You told me that.
I was never going to win that one. I shouldn't be joking. I was never going to win that one.
When was your last bet, so Tony? How long are you?
2nd of July 2011. I'll be 13 years free in a couple of weeks. And it's actually a lovely anniversary because I'm actually longer not gambling this year than I ever was fully gambling.
Oh, fantastic.
It's a nice one. I don't really celebrate the days as much as I would have at the start.
Yeah.
But
would there be
years.
I suppose we'll say no leading up to Galway races, would you be aware of that?
No, I couldn't even name one horse at this moment.
Yeah.
I'd be aware of beyond because you'd hear people talking about, but it's kind of the external triggers for me to gamble are a little bit like white noise in the background most of the time. It's the internal triggers that when I feel overwhelmed or I feel stressed or feel low myself, sometimes that can lead back to, it probably goes back to the shopping and the comfort eating first. Like I still get compulsions the odd time to gamble, but not as much as I would to shop. Like even coming to Dublin to train, I'm thinking, right, Tower Eck horse to try. And then I'm watching the Black Pumas on the telly outside. Oh, yeah. The band, I'll buy that fine. So I have that in me that I have to buy this fine off because I heard some of the music. So that's still very much in me that I have to. Yeah, it's still.
Would you
very
reach
much
out for help?
I do. I have supervision. I still engage my own counselling every so often. My partner's brilliant to support me. I'm surrounded by a lot of really good people that and I suppose I'm, the big part of my recovery, I'm sure you'll agree, is being open and honest and owning
and having
it.
A wonderful family. Yeah. From what you said there about your family, the way your dad copped the cobbles outside Paddy Power, knowing you were in Belfast, Googled all the different Paddy Powers, zoomed in, found the cobbles and found you. Yeah. I just think, I'm bawling over that.
It's mad how they found your family. Like, and luckily they did because I could have been another one of those gambling suicide related statistics, which we
heard
so
that's
much
pretty high, isn't it? The gambling related
suicide. The one in the UK is there's one gambling related suicide every day. So by the time we all go to bed tonight, someone will have taken their own life because of gambling addiction. And like that's one person too many for something that's supposed to be fun and entertainment. Yeah. So it's something I'm lucky that I'm one of the few that's come out. And I always say my story is a story of addiction and theft and money and bets and Norwegian women's football team. But it's a story of hope that you can come out the far side and have a life that's very fulfilling. It's normal, it's ups and downs like everyone else, but also I know how to cope a little bit better now than I did before. Before my coping skill, well, a little bit better, like shopping is still there a little bit, but I'm a lot better and I'm able to allow myself to be vulnerable and ask for that help, whereas before I didn't know how to. So that's the one thing I learned in Coombeira and probably in the 13 years recovery is how to ask for that help and that support, and hopefully I can impart some of that knowledge onto other people going forward.
And most importantly, you have peace of mind as well.
Hugely. I remember one of the nuns in Coombeira, she said to me, she said, you have to get to a place with peaceful regret. You can look back and give out to yourself. And I do sometimes. Like it comes up every so often where the guilt and the shame hits me like a ton of bricks. I still have reoccurring dreams or nightmares, you want to call them, every so often I'm back in a situation waiting to be caught again. So there's probably still a little bit of trauma still there over the whole thing. But I remember she saying, you have to get to a place with peaceful regret. And it was always a lovely way of putting it because that's where I am. Like, I look back every so often and say, geez, how did you, every time I mention figures, I kind of go, how did I get to that? But I can look back now and say, I made a mistake. I'm trying to be the best version of myself going forward for me, for my daughter, for my family, for my partner. I don't always get right. Like, no one does. No one's perfect. Yeah. But I try to be the best version going forward. And so another thing I'd always say is like I had to try separate who I believe I am as a person now for my behaviour in addiction, because I wasn't a nice person in addiction. I was a horrible person. But I believe now I'm pretty okay. So I have to try remind myself of that every so often, because you do get enough reminders on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis of the damage you cause and the hurt you cause as well. So it can be tough.
Tony, on that note, thank you so much for coming in. That's just an incredible story. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks,
today.
Thanks for having
fabulous
me.
Fabulous, Tony. And your book as well, if people want to get it online and any bookstores and all that, 2010. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much.
Since then, Tony has changed his life completely.
He went on to get his degree in counselling and physiotherapy and now...
psychotherapy.
What's it called? Physiotherapy.
Psychotherapy.